Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
I stepped aside and let Len take the lead. We stopped at the edge of the living room, looking at the blood-stained carpet where I'd found Axel. "What are we looking for?" I asked. The room was untouched since the crime scene techs had gone through, leaving a thin layer of black fingerprint dust on all the surfaces. Axel's furniture was neat and clean, but dated. A gold and green plaid couch, which appeared to be a hideaway bed, took up one wall. Hanging over the couch was a large framed print of a seascape. The other wall had matching green recliners set on each side of a small table with a lamp. Axel's sole form of entertainment, other than Tucker, was a 19-inch television with a loop antenna on top, leading to a converter box. I'd heard Axel was too cheap to pay for cable when he could get one Duluth station very nicely with his garage sale antenna and the converter box paid for by the government. A small desk under the window had pigeonholes, each with a neat stack of envelopes or papers, a ceramic coffee mug emblazoned with the logo of the local home health care company held scissors and an assortment of pens and pencils. A lap drawer had been left partially open by the investigators. Past an open pocket door was a bedroom alcove with a double bed and a bedside table. A dog-eared paperback lay next to the lamp near a pair of reading glasses. The bedding was piled in the center of the bed, in contrast to Axel's usual military neatness. Notably missing from the apartment were pictures. Nearly every resident decorated their apartment with pictures of their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Some apartments were so cluttered with photos, it appeared that the walls required reinforcement to sustain the load. Every desktop and dresser were usually covered with picture frames. The only picture Axel had was of him getting a military medal. It was now on the kitchen counter, its broken glass and frame dusted with black powder. Len put his hands on his hips and studied the room. "I don't know. Considering that the BCA went over the place with a fine-toothed comb, I don't expect that there's much here that hasn't been examined." "Did they find anything of interest?" Len nodded toward the desk. The desk drawer was ajar, and the BCA found a military medal inside. "Axel really was a hero?" I asked. "Apparently," Len replied. "The BCA found a British decoration with his name engraved on the back." "Did the BCA have any other revelations?" I asked. "No one told the BCA that Axel lived with a dog, so I got a nasty message complaining that it was going to take them a year to sort through the shopping bag of dog hair they got in their vacuum." Len chuckled a little. "They actually asked when the rug had last been vacuumed." "Housekeeping runs a vacuum through every week, but I doubt they are as diligent as the crime scene techs." "Their other question was, what breed of dog shed that much?" "Tucker is a basset hound mix," I said. "I think he weighs 45 pounds. "They thought that the dog had to be the size of a pony to leave that much hair behind. Axel claimed that he was part St. Bernard, but I doubt that he has much to do with the quantity of hair. I think he's just a prolific shedder," I offered. "I appreciate a little gallows humor sometimes," Len said, "but let's get serious and look for a murder weapon. The ME said that the knife was no more than a half inch wide and 6 inches long." I did the math quickly in my head. "That's somewhere between a fillet knife and an ice pick." Len walked into the kitchen and started pulling out drawers. I was thinking a stiletto or maybe a sharp letter opener. I wandered into the bathroom and stared at the white tile, the white tub, the white sink, white towels, and the birch cabinets, and I thought I was going snowblind. There wasn't a smudge, a stray hair, a crumpled tissue, or wrinkled towel in sight. I opened the medicine cabinet and stared at the array of bottles. Looking for the little blue pills, I jumped at the sound of Len's voice. I hadn't heard him come into the bathroom. Not specifically, I replied. The county deputies told me about the confrontation in the hall. Some little woman accused Axel of being a Lothario. Actually, she used a different word, but the meaning was clear. She thought that his wife hadn't been dead long enough to be with other women. So, is there a bottle of Viagra on the shelf? The shortest bottle was Vicks VapoRub, and the tallest was glucosamine. The range of meds ran from aspirin to zinc lozenges lined up in alphabetical order. The only prescription medications in here are Percocet, Lipitor, and Lasix. I pulled open the drawer under the sink. I started picking up the items and read the labels. Crest, Preparation H. "Do you think any of the female staff members might have had something romantic going with him?" Len asked. "No way. I can't imagine any of them having anything to do with him. They've said that he was a creep who was always trying to cop a feel or peek down the front of their blouses." I put the tubes back in the drawer and used a little toilet paper to wipe the black fingerprint powder off my fingers. "But he claimed to have lots of money. He had a car and he bathed regularly. That's about as good as it gets when you're an octogenarian." "Come back to the living room, Pete." We stopped behind Axel's favorite recliner and looked at the bloodstain on the floor. "What do you see?" "I see a large spot of blood on carpeting that will have to be replaced before anyone else can move in here." "No tip tables or lamps or other signs of struggle," Len observed, ignoring my comment. "The coroner didn't find any skin under his fingernails, defensive wounds, or scratches to indicate that he'd been in a struggle." "So it was someone he knew?" I asked, trying to figure out if Len was testing me or just letting me engage in the process. "Or it was someone who was able to sneak up on him. Axel wasn't deaf, but he always had the television volume cranked up pretty loud," I mused. "I guess someone could have come in the door and walked up behind him." "What about the dog? Wouldn't he make a racket if someone came in the room?" "Tucker has a happy bark, and he kind of bays or howls when he's unhappy. Maybe Axel wouldn't notice if the barking sounded friendly." "In that case, it would have been someone that Tucker recognized," Len said. I briefly contemplated the list of residents. "There are only a dozen men, one less now, with Axel gone, and I've already spoken with most of them. I suppose I could start talking to each of the women, too." I tried to sound skeptical, since I really had many other things to do besides chatting up all the female residents. Len gave me a sly smile, and I knew this wouldn't be an argument I could win. "But, Len, they all want to chat, sometimes for hours. It could take days or even weeks for me to have a meaningful discussion with each of them." Len patted me on the shoulder. "Take good notes. I find that without good notes, all the interviews start to run together in my head by the time we get to trial." Whistling Pines, Chapter 11. All the staff carried cell phones with a voice-activated walkie-talkie feature. Jenny's voice came to me as if she were hooked on my belt. "Peter, could you give us a hand in Peggy Johnson's room, please?" "Jenny," I said, pausing for the circuit to open in response to my voice, "I'm on my way." Peggy was a stout woman who'd worked a dairy farm with her husband. They'd sold the farm, but Peggy had plenty of muscle packed on her frame, which had slowly turned to gelatin in her retirement. She lived independently, roaming the halls with her walker, eating bread with lots of real butter and drinking whole milk at every meal. Her apartment door was jammed open, and I could hear voices in the bathroom. Peggy was sitting on the toilet with a towel draped over her lap, while Jenny and one of the aides, Marcy Copeland, squatted next to her. Peggy looked up at me as red slowly crept up her neck and into her face. Her blue slacks were around her ankles. As always, her retouched brown hair was carefully permed to make her look taller than her 5'2" frame. "Oh, Peter, I'm so sorry to drag you up here." Jenny pulled me to Peggy's side. "I'm going to slip a posy belt around Peggy's tummy, and when we've got that buckled, I want you to lift on the belt from the back while you gently lift Peggy's arm with your free hand." Peggy was shaking her head. "This is so embarrassing, to think that I had to drag people up here to get me off the toilet." She clucked her tongue as Jenny and Marcy slipped the heavy cotton belt around her middle. "It's all because of the Reader's Digest. I got caught up in an article about a family that was raising triplets, and time just slipped away from me. Next thing you know, I'm sitting here and my knees and hips are locked up." Jenny smiled and nodded, signaling me to start the lift. Marcy stood in front of Peggy, and we eased her into a stooped standing position, still mostly poised over the porcelain. I discreetly stared at the open bathroom door where Kathy, the director, had appeared during the process. "Okay, now give me a second to get my knees in gear," Peggy said as Marcy raised her slacks. Jenny reached to unbuckle the posy belt, and I got a brief whiff of her perfume as she mouthed, "Thank you." "Peter, when you've got a second, I'd like to talk to you about the funeral," Kathy said as she pushed Peggy's walker within reach. "Someone called about bagpipes." "I knew it," Peggy said, surprising us all. "I told them that the bagpipes weren't just a rumor. Wait until I call Audrey." "Now wait, Peggy," I said. "I'm in charge of the music, and I haven't arranged for bagpipes." "I know," Peggy replied as she slowly pushed past me. "It's the family. They're doing it because Axel was so proud of his service with the Brits during the war." Kathy, with her perfectly coiffed hair and gray silk blouse, peeked around the door, gave me a withering glare, and nodded toward the hallway. In the hall, she jammed a pink message slip at me. "Tell me about the bagpipes, Peter." "There are no bagpipes," I said, as I unfolded the message. "Then explain why I got a call from the St. Paul Police Federation. They want to know what time we want the pipers and if we want a full police honor guard, too." Kathy stood with her arms folded across her chest. The message was from Angus McTavish and gave a St. Paul, Minnesota area code. "I honestly don't know a thing about this," I said, waving the note. "Someone started a rumor that there's going to be bagpipes, and it seems to have gotten out of hand." I spoke with Mr. McTavish, and he said they'd had a message from a woman asking them to contact Peter at Whistling Pines, who was asking about the pipers for a retired policeman's funeral. "It seems the only hitch is that they can't find Axel Olson on the roster of retired St. Paul policemen." I don't think he was a cop. I think he was dabbling in local real estate and mostly lived to make people angry. I tried to hand the note back to Kathy, who kept her arms crossed. "Please call Mr. McTavish, who told me to call him Gus, and advise him of the confusion about Axel's status as a police veteran and offer him our apologies." Kathy had a persona that went from Jekyll to Hyde in a matter of seconds. I'd seen her charm little old ladies and their families with a delightful smile and a soft voice. The other half of that persona was reserved for the staff who have all suffered frostbite as a result of Kathy's icy glares or have looked forward to the brimstone of the depths of hell when she put an edge on her voice and whispered invectives to them. At this point, her voice was so soft that I had to lean closer to hear her words. It was nice that she'd said please, but there was no confusion that this was nothing less than an order which was not to be questioned. I quickly assessed my options, which seemed to be calling Gus McTavish immediately or starting to clear out my desk. "I'm on it," I said, expecting some expression of thanks or encouragement. The glare continued, which left me with the belief that I wasn't moving quickly enough toward the phone. One other thing, Peter, Kathy caught me in mid-turn. Yes? It seems that the residents are very interested in hearing bagpipes at Axel's funeral. Perhaps you should see if you can find a piper. I turned to leave again, only to be caught short. Peter, any cost will have to come out of your entertainment budget unless you can get the family to pay. I understand. As I scrambled away, I quickly ran through the options to pay for bagpipes out of my budget. I came to the quick conclusion that there weren't any options short of parking the van for half the year and giving out pennies instead of dimes as bingo prizes. Those being unreasonable, I came to the conclusion that I had to find a way to get Axel's family to pay. My office had been a storage closet until the mess in my cubicle, which was visible from the lobby, became such an eyesore that Kathy decided to give up the storage space. She also suggested that the door remain closed at all times. I paused at the corkboard mounted on my door to see how many of the residents had signed up for a ride to the funeral. I'd left 16 open slots, which was our van's capacity. All 16 slots were filled, and additional names crammed the open area at the bottom and sides of the sheet. It looks like we'll be making at least 2 trips between Whistling Pines and the church, I said to myself. By contrast, the sign-up sheet for the trip to Walmart had only 3 signatures. I filed the drafts of activity plans with the confirmations from the businesses that agreed to let a busload of seniors inside. Walmart was always great, but some of the local restaurants were less than enthusiastic about a busload of elderly people who ate slowly, tipped poorly, sometimes got trapped in the bathrooms, and stole the toothpicks and mints near the cash register. After a few minutes of filing, I found the phone and had a bare surface to write. Gus McTavish of the Police Federation Emerald Society sounded like a jovial guy who laughed heartily when I explained the rumor mill run amok and all the little old people badgering me about the bagpipes. I wish you luck, Peter. Sounds like you've got a challenge. Do you know of any bagpipe groups in northern Minnesota? Well, there used to be some old farts who played up in McGregor, but they weren't a group or anything. I think they used to pull out the pipes on St. Patrick's Day just to irritate their neighbors. I could see if any of our guys can remember their names. I suppose there is a chance they may all be dead. They weren't spring chickens when we heard about them back in the 80s. Please give me a call if you get a name, but there isn't much time to get this lined up. The funeral is in a few days. Is there any way I could talk you into sending up a piper or two for the day? Gus laughed. Peter, how far north are you? 150 miles from St. Paul? That means a whole day in the car to play Amazing Grace and Loch Lomond for a bunch of little old ladies. I doubt that I'd be able to find anyone who would be interested in taking a day of vacation for that duty. After offering my understanding and thanks, I hung up and pulled up Google on my computer. The search combination of bagpipes and funeral brought up a whole string of websites for people who play bagpipes for a variety of events. One very clever site, pipesforhire.com, offered the services of a piper for any event in the Chicago area. Another site was specific to Montreal, and there were dozens in Scotland and Ireland offering local piper services. When I narrowed the search to bagpipes and Minnesota, I got an interesting string of possible hits that had nothing to do with me finding a piper for a funeral in 2 days. I did find a massage therapist in Winnipeg, Manitoba, who advertised her services on a webpage that showed her holding bagpipes and wearing only a kilt while O Canada played in the background. The note at the bottom of her webpage suggested that customers would find out whether a piper wore anything under his or her kilt and listed a 1-900 phone number, which I knew was a phone exchange that charged by the minute. I had an inkling that this massage therapist had some other sidelines, like a phone sex business, that might not be acceptable to many of my senior citizens. It was at this point in my doldrums that Jenny chose to check in on me. Peter, I don't think we're allowed to view that type of material on the work computers, she said, peeking over my shoulder. Besides, I can give you a better massage than some bimbo from the internet. Embarrassed at being caught with a half-nude woman on my computer screen, I stammered, I found this in my search for bagpipes in the Minnesota region. I'd say she should find kilts that match the plaid of her bagpipes, Wendy, who appeared out of nowhere, added, looking over my other shoulder. Who gave the okay to check out porn on Peter's computer? I wasn't looking at porn. I explained I was looking for someone to play bagpipes. So you've got her coming for the funeral? Wendy asked as she reached across my keyboard to page down to the contact information. No, I haven't got her coming to the funeral. I quickly clicked the mouse to return to the search screen before we accidentally sent in a query or something. She's somewhere in Canada, and she probably only uses the bagpipes as a prop for her ad. I could load a CD on the church sound system, Wendy offered, trying to get back to the screen with the topless piper, and we could have her stand up front pretending to play the pipes. I wrestled the keyboard away from Wendy and unplugged the mouse. Stop it. We're not having a topless hooker pretend to play bagpipes for Axel's funeral. Jenny was trying to stifle a laugh while watching Wendy try to wrest the computer keyboard back from me. Shh, be quiet. Here comes some residents, said Jenny. Peggy Johnson wheeled her walker to my door just as Wendy pulled the keyboard out of my hands. Oh, am I interrupting something? Not at all, I said. Wendy was just leaving. Well, I got in touch with my sister Olivia. She's at a nursing home in Eveleth. She's going to have her activities director call you, Peter, to get the details of the funeral. They might bring a busload of people over to hear the bagpipes, too. Peggy, it's not a concert, it's a funeral, I said, trying to hide my irritation. I don't think it's appropriate to bring people to Axel's funeral who've never met him. Peggy stuck out her wrinkled lower lip like a pouting child. But no one's ever heard bagpipes in person before. It's going to be such a treat. Behind me, Wendy's fingers were flying over the keyboard. Suddenly, O Canada was playing. Peggy, wouldn't it be fun to have this girl play for the funeral? Wendy asked. Well, she certainly looks like she could play the pipes, but I think she'd be awfully cold not wearing anything to cover her little boobies. Peggy pressed closer. I've always wondered if they had underwear under those kilts. Jenny finally lost it and started to laugh, which she quickly turned into a fake coughing fit. She put her hand under Peggy's arm and guided her to the door. I think we need to leave Wendy and Peter to their search for a piper. Maybe we can get Conrad Carlson to play Loch Lomond on the accordion, Wendy said as she shut the Canadian site down. Connie was playing at the Dewdrop Inn last weekend and did a pretty good rendition of You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, Lucille. He said he'd never tried it before, so it was all by ear, and would have brought tears to Kenny Rogers' eyes. I just shook my head. Yes, Wendy, I think that probably would have brought tears to Kenny Rogers. Whistling Pines, Chapter 12. Irene Borzik was exiting the elevator as I passed and hailed me down. I pretended to not hear, fearing another bagpipe discussion, but she trumpeted my name so every head in the lobby turned to see who was making the commotion. Peter, she said breathlessly, I've been trying to catch you since those policemen talked to me. She was pushing a walker with an oxygen tank strapped to one of the legs. The green hose ran from the tank to the cannula under her nose. Her face would have been pasty except for the layers of powder and rouge she put on each morning. Today she'd chosen a darker brown that contrasted with her white hair, making her look like she'd been to a tanning salon. I spun around and turned her toward a quiet corner of the commons, away from the front desk. How can I help, Irene? We stopped a few feet past the aviary where the doves were cooing and waited for Irene to catch her breath. She'd been a bookkeeper for the local car dealership until her retirement, so she was a whiz with numbers and often beat the others handily at bridge because she could remember which cards had been played when short-term memory problems haunted many of the other players. Peter, she wheezed, you know that I live right under Axel's room. Tucker had been baying for a few minutes before I heard the thump. That was probably Axel falling down. I heard voices, too, but I couldn't tell what they were saying. Was it a male or female voice that you heard? Well, I heard Axel quite clearly. He was laughing about something, but the other voice was too soft to make out, especially with Tucker making all that noise. Axel was laughing? I asked. I certainly think so. It sounded like he was laughing, and the other voice was soft. I looked at the hearing aid that looped behind her ear, wondering if she was credible. Peggy Johnson edged over to where we were standing and heard that we were discussing Axel. Bert Sugarman did it, she announced in her outdoor voice. I patted Irene on the arm, then pulled Peggy closer, hoping that the close proximity would make her lower her voice. Who is Bert Sugarman, and why do you think he did it? I saw him at Mass this morning, she said, in a slightly softer version of the outdoor voice. I peeked at the reading room. Every head was turned to hear Peggy's pronouncement. It was his eyes. He had so much evil pent up inside him that his eyes were bugging out. I don't know what else could cause that much evil to push that hard. Well, not unless he's gambling again. I pressed my fingertips to my temples and closed my eyes. His eyes bug out, so he's the murderer? It's obvious, Peggy stated emphatically. His eyes have stuck out since he was a kid, Irene said. He's always looked a little like one of those tropical bush babies. That's why all the kids used to call him Bug. The always helpful Wendy happened to hear all the conversation and drifted over. I think he looks more like one of those honey drippers that they sell as pets. The corners of her mouth crinkled with a hint of a grin, and then she left me with the escalating Sugarman discussion. No, Peggy stated firmly, his eyes have gotten much more buggy since Axel's death. His eyes got that way when he hit puberty because all those carnal thoughts he kept pent up inside. But now they're much buggier. There was a flash of rusty brown at my feet, followed by Miriam, sporting a new, close-cropped haircut and a white uniform. Tucker, come back here, bad dog! Tucker! She yelled as she raced past us. She yelled a saltier version of Tucker's name as she chased the loping dog, who managed to slip out the front door. Get back here!
You've been listening to Episode 6 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the homepage. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.